It's Friday. Time for our reporter roundtable here on Idaho Matters. Our panel today, Nicole Foy, an investigative reporter with the Idaho Statesman who reports on government accountability, Latinos in Idaho, and agriculture. Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com. And Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press who covers Boise and the Idaho Capitol and is the reporter for the Eye on Boise blog. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hello.
Yeah, happy Friday.
Before we get into our conversation today, we have a request of our listeners. You know, we are marking tomorrow the one-year anniversary of the first confirmed COVID case here in Idaho, and life has changed a lot in the last year, and we want to hear your stories. So send us a voicemail, 208-426-3625. Again, that's 208-426-3625, and we may just use it on a program next week. All right, let's get into it. Speaking of COVID, Nicole, let's start with the vaccine rollout because the state is continuing to tweak when certain groups are eligible. In fact, I believe the vaccine committee is actually meeting right now to talk about group three and what that will look like. But starting on Monday, Nicole, we're looking at people like in the ag sector, like grocery store employees. And we're going to see more, employer-based clinics?
Yeah, we're going to start seeing a lot more vaccines open up to people, like you said, in the ag sector, in the food sector. Food workers is kind of how they're categorized. So that means farm workers, dairy workers, people in food processing plants, people working in grocery stores, and anything involving the people who have been making sure that we've been able to eat all year during a pandemic. it's going to be really interesting to see how this rolls out because like you said, it's going to be a lot of employer-based vaccines, especially when we're dealing with food processing plants that are employing hundreds of workers, some farms that are employing hundreds of workers. They're trying to work with local health districts and health organizations like Terry Riley, especially here in Canyon County, to try to find the best way to make sure that their workers get vaccinated. And sometimes the best way is bringing out a clinic to the food processing plant, to the farm out in Wilder. So we're going to be starting to see a lot of that. And that's, I think, going to make a big impact on not just as ag is really ramping up for the year. You know, that's something that they really want to make sure happens quickly. But also, we've talked on this program before about how Latinos in particular in Idaho have had very low vaccination rates so far, especially in comparison to their white counterparts. This is really the first industry that that has been prioritized for vaccines that has a significant Latino presence. So we might start seeing those numbers change, which is kind of exciting.
And you also mentioned, Nicole, that that they're really looking in particular with farm workers, which we know tend to be majority Latino, about making sure that they have access, because this has, as you mentioned, been an issue. I mean, we're starting to get more data about
this. There are already some attempts that are going to be happening in the next few weeks, specifically setting up clinics that meant to be specifically for Latino farm workers. And part of the reason is for that is that we've talked a lot and seen a lot of reporting about who has difficulty getting access to vaccines. And there's all kinds of things that can converge to make it difficult, whether you have reliable internet access, whether you have legal status or citizenship that makes you feel comfortable going to get a vaccine, even though you don't need either of the, you don't need that in Idaho to get a vaccine. You know, if you have steady access to healthcare and know the first person to turn to if you need any type of health assistance, or if you live in a rural area. And in Idaho, Latino farm workers really sometimes hit all of those same categories that can make it really difficult for them to, you know, maybe take time off work to get a vaccine or to find a place that they feel safe doing that. So there are also, in addition to employers opening up their businesses so that their own workers can get vaccinated. There's also just, I know Terry Riley and the Mexican consulate, and there's a lot of people that we're going to be seeing in the next couple of weeks working to make sure that you can get a vaccine even if you don't have all of the things that might make it easier, like computer or internet connection or legal status.
Betsy, fill us in on this bill about the state being required to pay parents if they choose to pull their kids out of school.
Yes, there was a bill that passed the House that says if parents pull their kids out of public school because that public school is not full-time in person, the school district would be required to pay over to the parents its a prorated share of its state funding per student. In other words, hand it over to the parent to do whatever they wish with as far as educational expenses. And it's kind of, there's been a kind of a groundswell in the House, particularly among House Republicans, of objecting to this idea of schools not being in person. But the vast majority of Idaho schools are doing in-person instruction right now. I think that there are 27 school districts left that are not full-time in person. During the debate on this bill, there were even comments that Idaho schools have been shut down for a year and why are we wasting our money on schools that aren't educating kids and so on. And I did check with the State Department of Education and no, our schools have not been shut down for a year. During the shutdown last spring, they did go to remote learning and then there's been a variety of blended and hybrid learning and every school district is making its own decision. But this bill is trying to take that decision and put it directly in the parents' hands as far as the funding.
And then just this morning, Betsy, an education spending bill was introduced.
Actually, the public school budget was set this morning.
Okay. It was kind
of wham, bam, there it was. And surprisingly, this was in the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee. It was a series of unanimous votes. Only one of the six divisions was not unanimous, and it had only two no votes, and that was because of a side issue that a couple of members mentioned. There seemed to be actually widespread agreement on the public school budget for next year. It's a 3.7% increase in state general funds, which matches the governor's original recommendation, but it has a lot of different moving parts, having to do with the fact that in total funds, it's a 13.2% increase. That's because of all the federal COVID relief funds that are being rolled into the budget. Now, some of those were proposed by the governor as supplemental appropriations for the current budget year, and JFET split them up so that some of them go into next year's budget. And that's why that number is higher. But there's funding there for addressing what they call learning loss, the impact of all the disruptions that we've seen in education in Idaho and how to help students get back up to speed. There's funding for literacy help. There's funding for quite a few different pieces and also fully making up all of the cuts that were made to the school budget because of the governor's holdbacks this year. Those are being restored this year and next year.
Okay, but with that being said, Dawn, let's stay with this theme of education because Powerball brings in about $14 million a year in funding for Idaho public schools. That could be going away.
Yeah, it could. And oh, my phone is ringing as I start to talk to you. I can't hear a thing. Okay. So Keith Riddler over at the Idaho Press, the Associated Press, I saw it on the Idaho Press. See, I'm all thrown off now. Had a good story about this. And Powerball needs a little permission slip from the Idaho legislature because the current law says that these multi-state games can only be among U.S. states and Canada. Powerball would like to expand and has decided to expand to include Australia in 2021 and Britain in 2022. Well, for Idaho to remain in the game, that would be against Idaho state code. So Jeff Anderson, the lottery director, went to the legislature. They had a bill drawn up that would make this small change, and there was some concern. And Betsy, I don't know if you watched this hearing or not, so you might be able to speak to this, but it seems like it centered primarily around some concerns that maybe these Powerball winnings could go to governments that have some ideas that are antithetical to some of the Idaho politicians' ideas. We'll see if this gets sorted out. The Idaho Lottery wouldn't initially talk to me. They told me to go read the Associated Press story, essentially. And then later, yeah, it was kind of a funny thing. And then later put out some information to their VIP club members, which I just happened to be on their mailing list. And so I got more information that way. The spokesperson later told me that Lottery Director Jeff Anderson really hopes to find a solution to this, whether it's legislative or maybe there's some other option out there. They didn't really say. But if the Multi-State Lottery Association continues on with its plan, come August, Powerball wouldn't be available in Idaho. Some of the other games, Mega Millions is the big the biggie, would continue on. Idaho has a long history with Powerball, more than 30 years, including its predecessor game. And the Powerball drawing even came to Idaho in 2014. When I was over at Channel 7, I actually helped put this together where the live TV drawing was broadcast from the Idaho Stampede with Governor Butch Otter. And the game's always been popular in Idaho. So I'll be interested to see if there's a solution here, and maybe Betsy has reporting to that.
Well, ironically, the very day that the House committee was making that decision, Idaho had two $50,000 winners in the Powerball drawing.
Was a news release on that. Yeah, that was well timed, right?
Yeah, and Dawn, I did not watch that hearing because I was watching another hearing that was occurring at the exact same time. Just as this morning, while the public school budget was being set, the new tax cut bill was being introduced. It is big. It cuts income tax rates and would give very large tax rebates to high-income earners in Idaho. It's very controversial. There's a heck of a lot happening at the State House right now.
It's not the first time that somebody has said we need three Betsys, so.
Well, right, we do. We need to clone you, Betsy. We're going to take a quick break. We have a lot more to get to with our reporter roundtable. Stay with us. Continuing with our reporter roundtable today, our panel, Nicole Foy with the Idaho Statesman, Dawn Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press. Betsy, can you get us updated on what happened with the bill that would have made it illegal to protest in front of someone's private home?
Well, that bill actually died in the House this week on a fairly narrow 31-38 vote. And earlier it had been up for amendments. It wasn't amended. It was pulled back to committee. An alternative version was introduced that would instead have targeted those, what they call doxing, where someone posts someone's home information to try to encourage people to go to their house and harass them. Both bills came back out of committee. One of them ended up getting killed in order to have the debate back on the original bill about protests at people's homes. And there was a very ardent debate, passionate debate, both for and against, but it went down. There was most of the debate from those supporting the bill focused on law enforcement officers. And in fact, we of course had a Meridian police officer have protesters come to his home to protest an arrest that he had made in the course of his job. Here we've also had protests at public officials' homes. But the opposition was mainly from people who said, hey, I don't want to do anything to restrict any constitutional rights.
Dawn, we've talked about this on the program before, but you've got some new details about this land swap issue in McCall, and details, frankly, that one company was trying to keep private.
Yeah, so as we've talked about at some length, Trident Holdings wants to convince the Idaho Land Board to swap for a significant chunk of land in the area around McCall. Describing this land is a little tricky, but the best way to say it is it's kind of the hills around McCall. They've been working this through. They put together a proposal, a formal proposal to the land board that they rolled out a month ago. They talked to me. We put this story out. But they provided me with a version of the proposal that had 64% of the entire document redacted. They also submitted to the Idaho Land Board, I think a couple days before they talked to me, a completely unredacted version of the proposal. They also told the state, hey, here's the copy of this redacted version that you should put out if anybody asks for it, citing trade secrets and appraisal of property. Well, the state of Idaho, when I requested the version from them, wisely decided that they would perform their own redactions, and quite a bit of additional information came to light, including some of the lands that they hope to acquire in North Idaho to swap for the lands around McCall. This gets a little complicated, but essentially, to make this happen, Idaho law allows for land swaps, but not land sales. It outlined in general terms what those lands were, but more importantly, it got to the valuation of the two different pieces of land, which was a really big important thing that had kind of been redacted out. They were saying, we want to swap, but we're not going to We're not going to reveal how much the land in McCall we think we want to get is worth, nor how much the timberland is worth, which made it a little difficult for the public to sort of say, okay, how do we evaluate this? So now we know that. We outlined it on BoiseDev.com. It's a little complicated to get into on the radio, but you can kind of see a little bit more of that. It's also interesting that initially Triton had said, we want to swap for all of the endowment land in the Payette Lake region to get the state of Idaho out of these sort of piecemeal sales of land. When they put together the formal proposal, what they did is they actually said, well, actually, you know what, we just want some of the land, and we're going to leave you the Idaho Land Endowment with these other parcels, and we're only going to take about half of the land as measured by monetary value. So that's changed a little bit, and it's really interesting. It's a complicated story. I've written probably 10,000 words on this, and I'm sure we'll write many more in months to come. And there's a land board meeting next week where we should actually hear more from the public and maybe get a little indication of what the elected officials that sit on that board think. And we'll have that for you on BoiseDev.com as well.
Okay. And then, Betsy, some lawmakers are taking aim at public art, basically deeming it unnecessary.
Frivolous, unnecessary, bottom of the priority list. These were some of the phrases that Representative Aaron Von Ellinger of Lewiston used to promote his bill. And he's really leading the charge on this. This is a freshman representative from Lewiston who doesn't like public art, and he specifically doesn't like certain public art, like the sculpture, the metal sculpture of Cottonwoods in front of Boise City Hall, and the canoe wave sculpture in Lewiston, and a small sculpture in Coeur d'Alene that was removed in 2019. And so he proposed legislation that at first would require a public vote, 2/3 in a November or May election, to approve any public art that costs over $10,000. Then he introduced a new version of his bill that raised it to $25,000. But that bill had its committee hearing this week. And artists and arts officials and local officials came out and said, no, there are reasons why we do this. We don't want the legislature to put all these requirements on it. This would be more costly. And the public art process in communities across the state is very open, and it involves a community and what public art they want. And it really looked like the bill was about to die in committee when Representative Mike Moyle rescued it, and it's on life support right now, by making a motion to send it to the amending order. That passed on an 8-7 vote. Representative Moyle's the House Majority Leader, so he's in charge of, you know, what bills come up, and he could get it to come up on the amending order. He said he doesn't have a problem with the vote, but gee, he wouldn't want to restrict anyone requiring a vote when it's funded by private donations. Basically, what we saw was a clash between a state representative who sees no value in public art and a whole lot of people from all over the state who are involved in the arts, who talked about the arts in Idaho, what they mean, what they represent economically and in terms of jobs, right, and sense of place and community. And we'll see what the outcome is.
Yeah, we definitely will. Nicole, we talked on our program a Wednesday with our medical experts about some higher levels of COVID being found in wastewater. This is in the Central District health area. Have we heard from representatives from CDH about this?
Yeah, so I in a story we published last night, I spoke with CDH just about, what are we seeing in these in the wastewater tracking, that of course is a method that many cities across the country are now using as kind of an early warning system to see when are levels of COVID rising in the community based on runoff from sewage in some of the cities. And that can help us see, you know, what are we about to have a surge in cases? And it's been pretty helpful in the past to kind of provide a little bit of a heads up that we might be seeing more, we might have more COVID circulating in the community. So we talked with Central District Health last night, and one of their technicians told me that what they have seen is in the last few weeks, they've seen a doubling in the amount of COVID detectable in this wastewater system. Now, you have to keep in perspective, and you can easily go look at the Central District Health's dashboard on this. The levels are nowhere near to where any of our previous surges are. It still looks like it's a downward trend in many cases, which is what you would expect with so many people in our community getting the vaccine. But it's still noteworthy because, of course, COVID is still present in our community. And also we, Central District Health just recently removed, there's mask orders for
the
some
mask
of
mandate.
The cities.
Yeah.
So of course, Boise still has a mask order. And that's, you know, that's one of the cities that's tracking this, but that it's if you can like cast your brain back to remember how we used to talk so much about these 2-week doubling periods back at the beginning of the pandemic. And so it's one of those things where it doesn't, it's an easy thing to see that we might be seeing more COVID in the community. But also it's just one measure that's being used to track it. More people are being vaccinated every day. But it's just something to keep in mind and something that Central District Health, again, emphasized, do your best to still be as careful as possible, especially if you've not been vaccinated yet. Wear a mask because people are still testing positive for COVID. That is still a thing, even though people are getting vaccinated. And it is entirely possible that some areas, whether that's our area or not, could have one last surge in cases or more if enough people contract COVID again before we reach some level of herd immunity.
Let's head back to the legislature and Betsy talk about there. A pretty significant transportation bonding bill is gaining some steam.
Yes. And actually, before I get to that, I just want to follow up on what Nicole said about people are still testing positive for COVID. We had an announcement at the legislature today that a member of the House has tested positive for COVID, and Representative Bruce Skog from Nampa acknowledged that he had. He is among those who have not been wearing a mask. And this brings the total number of infections at the State House during this session this year to 7, including 2 senators, 1 representative, and the remaining staffers in both the Senate and the House. So there's that. Now, on to the transportation bonding bill.
I like that, Betsy. There's that, too. So.
Currently, the state has been diverting a minimum of $15 million a year, or 1% of its sales tax proceeds, from the state general fund to the transportation department for road projects. And there's a bill from House Transportation Chairman Joe Palmer that will more than quadruple that to 4.5% of sales tax proceeds every year, or a minimum of $67 million a year. And at the same time, instead of sending it all to ITD, it would give a 30% share to local highway jurisdictions. And under a change that was made in 2019, all of the funds from this shift can be used for bonding. So the shift of the $67 million a year or more pays the payment on bonds for much larger transportation projects. So this bill came out of the House Transportation Committee this week, and it seemed to have pretty strong support. It's a significant hit to the general fund, but the general fund, of course, is growing, and we've had really kind of remarkable surges in state revenue. The idea is that this would, in some ways, perhaps indirectly offset local property taxes for those local highway jurisdictions that assess property taxes, because they now have this other source, this bond fund, to tap into for some projects. But it's also not a direct property tax relief bill. It's a transportation funding bill, as Representative Palmer made clear. I expect that to come up for a vote in the full House fairly soon. The House has adjourned for the day today, so it likely will be early next week. Now, what that would allow is bonding for up to $1 billion in road projects between the state and local projects. That is a lot.
That's a lot. Okay, so Don, let's keep with this transportation thing, because ITD, Idaho Transportation Department, had some big plans for a new intersection at Eagle and State. And I mean, look, all I did was look at the drawing and I couldn't understand it. So I can't imagine actually trying to drive through it.
Yeah, well, the Idaho Transportation Department produced a video that is 2 minutes and 31 seconds long to explain it, which for those of us former TV newsers like Gemma, that's a long time.
That's a really long time.
It's a really long time. So essentially what they wanted to do, oh, I got to explain this on the radio now. I should have thought of this when I pitched it. For traffic that's on State Street, you know, traditionally you'd pull up to a light and you'd sit there and you wait for traffic and then you would cross over if you were turning left. The configuration would have shifted the lanes all the way to the other side of the road, to the right side of the road. So you'd be on the quote unquote wrong side of the road to make that left turn. And the social media comments on some of the mainstream Facebook pages for the Channel 7s and the other statesmen of the world were really negative. People were like not happy. And we got a tip that ITT was reconsidering it, which blew my mind because we had first had this in a story, like I think 2 years ago, that this was on their long-term roadmap. They had done a fairly big media push last month. They were everywhere. I mean, they were on the TV stations and there was stories in the newspaper. We hadn't done the story, which was to my error, but we got this tip that they were reconsidering it. And I called Vince Stromboli over at the Idaho Transportation Department, and he was very forthright and said, you know what? Yeah, we're giving this another look due to the feedback. Now, Vince said essentially that this would be a relatively easy thing to fix. It wouldn't change the timeline. It wouldn't change the cost. They essentially would just kind of put the lanes back in a traditional way. And he also said that there's not a big difference in the impact on delay. Right now, drivers who are at the light wait about 118 seconds more than they should at a peak hour, like evening rush hour. If they do this funny left lane on the right side of the road thing, or on the left side of the road thing, see, it's so confusing, the delay would be 46 seconds. But if they were to redo the intersection and go to sort of a, well, there's that. But if they go to a traditional configuration, it would be 60 seconds. So the argument is it's only a difference of 16 seconds. Now, I asked Vince, like, well, that's maybe at the beginning, but what about down the road? And he said, yeah, you know, there would be a trend down and it would go kind of in sync. So they haven't made the decision yet, but they are reconsidering it. So we'll see if the public pressure here on this unconventional traffic configuration will cause them to make a change.
We're going to take a quick break. More with our roundtable next. Back with our Friday Reporter Roundtable right now. So, Betsy, Idaho Public Television funding narrowly passed.
It narrowly passed in the House. It hasn't been voted on yet in the Senate. But in watching the way the Senate has been handling budget bills, there's been very little controversy, very little debate. In the House, the vote was 36 to 34, and the opposition was led by Representative Priscilla Giddings of Whitebird, who claimed that programs like Arthur and Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood are, quote, partisan. And she mentioned as evidence that Arthur did a report on global warming and that there was a discussion about racism on Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. This is not new that we've had discussions about content of PBS programs during the course of the funding approval of the public TV budget, but it seems to be going to a greater extent perhaps than in the past. Of course, in recent years, we've had complaints about shows like Clifford the Big Red Dog. However, it passed and the budget likely will become law.
Yeah, let's go back to Mr. Rogers, right? I mean, he brought up these issues years ago. I mean, it is what... Anywho, Nicole, one of your colleagues actually, I think, wrote a really interesting article about, frankly, who would truly be impacted without IPTV funding?
Yeah, my colleague Hayat, she wrote about how, you know, the state appropriation funds that were really at risk with this budget, you know, about, correct me if I'm wrong here, Betsy, but a little more than $2 million out of about like a $9.6 million budget, that would have actually... those funds, and what they told my colleague Taya is those funds is what makes the broadcast to be offered statewide and not just to the Treasure Valley or Boise area. So it's really taking away that funding would have possibly put at risk the ability of people in, and honestly, some of these constituents of these of some of the lawmakers who are against it in areas like Whitebird or in areas that are far from the Treasure Valley, because there feasibly would be enough funds to support the broadcast from the Treasure Valley, but it would make it much more difficult for, you know, someone in some of these rural areas to, you know, I think one of the examples was, you know, catch a broadcast and opera performance from the Kennedy Center mm-hmm. that comes over PBS, or STEM curriculum for young people in some of these areas who their schools might not have some of these programs. And it's, yeah. And like Betsy said, it's interesting because the catalyst for some of, for these discussions that for, that would effectively take away, and in some cases create media deserts in some of Idaho's areas that has very little media coverage in general, is again, part of a trend that we've been seeing the entire legislative session, is issues with, so-called, you know, social justice programming, concerns over the inability to control the content that's coming, whether from PBS or local news. So it's really interesting because if those state funds had been removed, it would have effectively cut off some free news and programming that a lot of people rely on in areas where they may not get a lot of that locally.
Mm-hmm. And particularly in the state of Idaho, because of our geography, there is very little in the way of media that reaches the entire state. Idaho mm-hmm. Public TV is pretty much it.
Right. And I have to say, just from the standpoint of a mom, when my kids were super little, and I kid you not, I felt the most appropriate things that my kids could watch was on PBS Kids, just as an aside. Dawn, a longstanding Boise bar called The Crescent is no more.
Yeah, folks who've been around a while probably remember the Crescent over on Orchard Street, where the Campos right. Market is now. In fact, the sign out in front of campus still has a crescent on it. They moved over to Franklin Road in the early part of the 2000s, a large 8,000 square foot bar and grill space. Boise Dev's Margaret Carmel, this is kind of funny. We're like, oh, we need to do this story. We got a tip. And I went over and there was a manager and he didn't want to say much, but he said, yeah, it's a Spokane group. And on our little group thread, I was like, yeah, the guy said it's a Spokane group. And Margaret goes, oh, I think I know who that is, because she's just so, you know, attention to detail kind of person.
Right.
And reached out to the person. And sure enough, so a Spokane group owned by Jordan Tampion says that he hopes to revamp the Crescent into two new concepts. One would be a higher end brunch spot, and the other half would be like a kind of a family friendly gastro pub. And then they also want to build some, no surprise here, some apartments on a portion of an unused portion of the parcel. So a pretty big change here. The Crescent is already closed, so if you're hoping to go get your last version of lawyer fries, you can't. This bar, many people may just know it as the No Lawyers Bar. In the mid-1980s, yeah. The owners, Butch and Jody Morrison, got into a legal dispute, spent a bunch of money on attorneys, and decided to. And this is one of those things where, and I wrote a line into the story that said that they decided to blow off some steam with the humorous but also serious rule barring lawyers. It was always hard to tell if they were serious or not. They said they would charge a surcharge, and I don't know, but...
That's hilarious.
So, you know, maybe if you're a lawyer, you can go to the replacement for the Crescent soon.
Well, I think there were lawyers, at least some of them, that that went on the DL. You know, they still.
Do you know any lawyers, Gemma?
a few.
Yeah.
I can't reveal all my sources.
I think the joke was like, if you're a lawyer and you want to come in, just keep your mouth shut.
Just keep your mouth shut or we're going to charge you more. Fair enough.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Look, some of those lawyers can get mouthy. That's all I'm saying. I want to thank all of you for coming in today, especially in the midst of such a busy legislative session. So appreciate your time. So our reporter roundtable this week, a huge thank you to Nicole Foy, an investigative reporter with the Idaho Statesman. Nicole reports on government accountability, Latinos in Idaho, as well as agriculture. Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief of the Idaho Press, who covers Boise and Idaho Capital, and she is the reporter for the Eye on Boise blog. Basically, Betsy is the OG of Idaho news. Thank you all so much. It's so true. It is. More Idaho Matters next.